Just before we broke for lunch, we talked about the three knowledges that form what the Buddha called the regularity of the Dharma, which is part of his awakening. Go over those again. First was remembrance of his previous lifetimes, seeing that they went up and down quite a bit. And then the second knowledge was seeing all beings dying and being reborn in line with their karma. That's when you begin to see the relationship between karma and the level of rebirth. Now we have to remember that this was not a belief that was universal in India at that time. Some people sometimes say that the Buddha just picked up the idea of karma and rebirth from his culture. And it was actually a hot issue. It was one of these things that people discussed quite a lot. One, was karma real? Did it have results? Was rebirth real? Was there any connection between the two? These were issues that were hotly debated in the Buddhist time. So he wasn't simply affirming a belief that he already had. It was something that was new, and particularly the way he described the relationship between karma and rebirth was distinctive to him. When he talked about rebirth, he never talked about what gets reborn. He talked about the process by which it happens. And this is important because the process is something that you can have some control over. If you said you had this soul that was going to be reborn willy-nilly, you couldn't do much about it. But if it was something that you were actually doing, you could change the course of your actions. That was the approach he took in the third knowledge, was to figure out some way how to put a stop to this. What was distinct about his knowledge here was that it was something you could actually do, and just his views and intentions of one sort that thought and saw the world in terms of becoming led to further becoming. When he got into the Four Noble Truths, the idea of the notions of who you are and the world in which you live are not part of the view. It's simply these actions lead to these results, those actions lead to those results. And those kinds of views, which are a kind of action, could lead to the end of action, could lead to the end of intention. So that was another distinctive part of his insight in that third knowledge. That the principle of causality that he discovered in the second knowledge showed that it was malleable, it was responsive to the mind, but there are certain things you can't just say, well, I want to do X and I want Y as a result. If you do X, X has its own results, and you have to learn how to basically learn the ropes to figure out how you can get out. It's not something you can just decide, I'm going to take this path to awakening because I like it. You choose a path because it works. That was the insight that he came to. Before we go on to a discussion of unbinding or nirvana, are there any questions about those three knowledges? You had a whole lunchtime to ruminate. Yes. Well, if the Buddha was talking metaphorically, he would have made clear the fact it was just a metaphor. And he was saying beings are dying and they're being reborn. In his description of the process of aging and death and rebirth, they're talking about the aging and death and rebirth of beings. Sometimes it's thought that the Buddha taught two levels of truth, you know, one level in which there are beings, another level in which there are no beings at all. But he never made that distinction. For him, a being was defined by a psychological process, i.e. the things that you are attached to, that's what makes you a being. Once you become a being, you have to feed. But you don't have to take on the identity of a being. In fact, you can, this is one of the insights that he came, that you drop the attachments by which you make yourself into a being, but you're not annihilated. There is an awareness that's left. And we'll talk about that a bit when we get into unbinding. But yeah, the idea that the Buddha was talking only metaphorically when he was talking about rebirth, it's basically a materialist idea, which, you know, you are your body, and when your body dies, that's it. Consciousness has to depend on a body. That's the belief that they would have. And that was not a Buddhist belief. He saw that consciousness was a process that could be kept going by craving and didn't require a body to keep it going. So this process can keep on going even when you leave the body. So no, for him it wasn't just metaphorical. I mean, he did talk about, you know, processes of becoming happening in the micro level in the mind, but he also saw that the micro level was what led to the macro level, where you are actually, you can't stay in this body any longer, and there's, you know, you're going to go find someplace else. There was that cartoon I saw. It was this person driving a car in California. It was obviously California because it had palm trees. And on the back was a little bumper sticker that said, "If you don't believe in reincarnation, better luck next time."
Yes. In one of the chants, or maybe more than one, about the Buddha, it was talking about different qualities, and one of them is knower of the worlds, knower of the world. And is this referring to kind of these insights?
Well, the knower of the world was a specific aspect of the knowledge of his awakening. And there's a really interesting sutta where the Buddha says, in addition to knowing the Four Noble Truths, knowing the five faculties, knowing the four frames of reference as being part of his awakening, another part of his awakening was that he had known what the different levels of being were, was able to talk to beings on the different levels, to check heavenly realms and lower realms. John Lee talks about talking to animals psychically. And basically the conversations, what did you get to eat today? Are you okay? It's pretty much animal. That is my bone. and also knowledge that he himself had been in these levels, and knowledge of the path of practice that would lead to these different levels. All of that was part of his awakening. So that would be part of knower of the worlds. In other words, knowing what kind of worlds there are, how you get there, what the limitations of those worlds are. No, an ordinary person doesn't need to know all that as part of the awakening, but to be a Buddha, to teach this and to sort of set it out, you've got to know these things.
And would that be kind of what is described on the night of his awakening, one of those watches?
Yeah, it would be the second knowledge. But the way he describes it, in the second knowledge, he doesn't talk about having conversations, but in one of his other psychic powers was that he could talk to beings of this kind, so that apparently that played a role as well. Working on this life of the Buddha, I'm discovering all these different passages where he talks about his awakening from different angles, finding some very unexpected ones. Like that's one of them. I'd had no idea he was having conversations with Davis, but he mentions that as part of the experience. Yes?
Nowadays with science and the neurophysicists and scientists looking at the brain, more and more they're starting to hone in on what's happening in the brain, the way it develops as opposed to us. How can we, as that distinguish where many neuroscientists basically say that's all I, and I forget what part of the brain they say is partly right within the brain, it's in this part of the brain, and yet the Buddhists have said, actually, we're not any of that. And yet the development happiness is saying, actually, you are the brain. Once it's dead, you're gone.
They don't have any proof of that, that once you're dead, you're gone. I mean, it's like saying, once your TV set breaks down, it's a sign that there are no signals coming from outside. So, I mean, if the TV set is malfunctioning, you can say, okay, obviously the TV set is malfunctioning. The signals that are coming in from outside may be getting garbled, which is a natural, to be expected. It's the same brain damage or any damage to any part of your body. It's not responding to the impulses. But from the Buddha's point of view, the Buddha doesn't look at us from the outside looking in, which is what the neuroscientists are doing. We're looking at sort of your consciousness, starting with your consciousness and looking out. And it gives you a totally different perspective on things. William James, Carl Jung wrote a lot about this, that the physical scientists are doing this thing. They're trying to take something that is not immediate part of your experience, i.e. atoms and neurons and that kind of thing, to describe something that is a direct part of your experience, i.e. consciousness. And they still haven't come up with any explanation why is it that just a physical body would have this kind of inner awareness. That bridge, that gulf has not been bridged.
Right.
And so you can say, well, your problems are your problems. My problem is I'm suffering. And the Buddha is saying the problem starts from inside. It's part of this, your awareness, which nobody else can have any contact with. That's your problem. But how you can do things inside your awareness that will put an end to the problem. And this is why, there is that verse at the beginning of the Dhammapada. This is the mind is the forerunner of all things. we repass it, and then we go on to something else, and it doesn't seem to be all that relevant to anything else we've read in the Buddhist teachings. Actually, it's at the basis of everything. The forerunner of all things, in other words. It is through the desires of the mind that we have experience of the phenomena. And how we're going to use those phenomena, whether we're going to use them for the sake of suffering more or putting an end to suffering, that's an impulse that comes from within. The resources to solve that problem also come from within. And there's no enlightenment cocktail of drugs that you can take that'll solve the problems for you. It's more inner skills that you have to develop.
So where is the mind?
That's one of those questions the Buddha says, hey, just solve the problem of suffering, and then we'll talk about that if you want. You know the story about the man shot with the arrow, you know. I will not have this arrow removed until I know, you know, where the arrow is or where it's from. Okay. That's the kind of... Yes.
My understanding, and you may correct me, is that our identity, our I, is built on our attachments and our circumstances and our actions of the now. Mm-hmm. So then what is it that gets, and it's kind of an illusion, it's temporary, it's a process that's built on what's going on. What is it that gets reborn?
Again, the Buddha doesn't say what gets reborn. He says this is a process, rebirth is a process too. When he talks about self, I mean, there is a teaching on not self, but he never says there is no self. And that's an important point to keep stressing, is that that's one of those questions he has you put aside. Is there a self? Is there no self? He says, look at things as a process, and just because it's a process doesn't mean it's illusory, and it doesn't mean it can't be used for some purpose. You know, processed cheese is a process, but you can you can use it.
It seems to me, though, that there may be a difference between self and identity.
Not really. The Buddha does not make a distinction between self and identity. He says, you create an identity, and we tend to be pretty sloppy and careless in how we do it. And the principle of self and not self is nothing really foreign to us, it's just that we tend to do it, you know, haphazardly. An example that I've given often is that you have a little sister and somebody down the street is beating her up. You go down and you defend her because she's your little sister, right? And then she comes home and she starts playing with your toy truck. She's not your little sister anymore. And so we tend to identify and disidentify with things as we go through the day. And this is part of this process of becoming. You know, when you have the desire for pizza, certain aspects of your personality are relevant, so that's what you're going to identify with at that point. And then we switch over to a political discussion. Okay, that a lot of the pizza identity goes away and you have another identity. And so there are things we identify and disidentify with all the time. The Buddha's basically saying, learn how to do that more systematically, more skillfully. Like identify with the desire for awakening, identify with the idea that you are competent to awaken. That's an identity you want to hold on to for a while. And the parts of you that go against that, you say, I can disidentify with that. So the fact that these things are processes mean you can do the process in a different way. But what it is behind there, he says, that's one of those questions. He says, don't ask that, because that just takes you down another route and it gets you away from the actual practice. Yes?
Maybe this kind of goes down that path, but would you be able to differentiate the concepts of consciousness, like as, is it vijnana?
Vijnana.
Vijnana. Mm-hmm. And then the citta? Is that consciousness too, or is that a different type of...
Vijnana is something the Buddha actually defines. He never defines citta. That's all I can say. And there are some cases where they seem to be interchangeable, and other cases where they're not quite. Because vijnana, consciousness, is basically the receptive side, receptive function of the mind. But the mind has these other functions as well. And one of the interesting things about Buddhism is the Buddha teaches you there is a way of training to put an end to suffering achieve true happiness. Training the mind to put an end to suffering and achieve true happiness. Mind, suffering, happiness are not defined. Training is very clearly defined. the Buddha focuses on. This is focus on what you're doing, and as for who's doing it and what's going to be a satisfactory result, that's going to develop as you practice. Yes. Okay, we're still talking about conviction, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, going a little, stepping back from that, what's the usefulness of discussing about the four factors of stream entry? I mean, for many of us who are far from that.
Okay, it's basically to give you an idea of where this is headed, and also the kind of the some of the beliefs that would be useful hypotheses to take on, that it is possible. Again, awakening through your efforts, a human action can do this, that you're not just your biology, that there's this aspect of the mind, an unconditioned dimension that the mind can access. That these are good working hypotheses to have. Yes? I mentioned it very briefly at the beginning about the difference between what a faculty is from a strength, but when you think of the analogy of the committee, a strength would be a strong member of the committee, and the faculty would be finally taking over the committee. And it relates to the word Indriya from Pali, which is related to Indra, the king of the gods. I still would like to find a better English definition for the word. Because faculty sounds kind of strange, but it is something that you want it to one of these qualities to dominate the mind, as opposed to just being strong. Yes. Well, the Buddha talks about them. You're developing at the same time, and then as you get further in the practice, that the strength becomes more dominant. The strength becomes dominant. In other words, turns from a strength into a faculty.
Which comes first?
Starts at the strengths. You've seen it when you meditate. You know, your concentration is fighting, but there's something else is more dominant. But you keep strengthening your concentration. Boom. Okay, you got it. Yes.
This morning you mentioned something about four factors for stream entry and of stream entry. Did you develop that?
Well, we did the four factors for stream entry, which are association with people of integrity, listening to Dharma, appropriate attention, and then practicing the Dharma in line with the Dharma. Now we're going on the four factors of stream entry, which first, verified confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, that's three. So we're working on the Buddha right now. Because the most important part of the Buddha was his awakening. I should have visual aids. That's a real whiteboard, huh?
And there's
a marker?
Although you're tethered.
I'm tethered at the moment, yeah. But when we have the break this afternoon, we'll have diagrams when we come back.
Yeah, we need the wireless mic. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Right. I mean, the Buddha's awakening was done in line with the principles of causality. In other words, he wasn't, you know, the causal features that keep the cycle going can also be used to break the cycle apart. You see, like with the Krebs cycle, there's certain things that are required to keep it going. Well, you begin to cut some of those things, but you also, the cutting of it also is a type of causality.
Right, yes, so if someone,
he's telling you where to cut.
Right, so that
or what the process of cutting would be, yeah.
You were talking earlier about causality being kind of two different parts. Mm-hmm. One is this happens, then this happens, and another is
they happen simultaneously.
These two things come up together.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Right.
Could you talk about that a little bit, the two things coming up together?
Well, it's just, you know, if you stick your finger in a fire, it burns right away. It doesn't have to wait until your next lifetime. Right? You take it out of the fire and it stops burning, right?
Yes.
That's the kind of thing. And so whenever there's going to be clinging, there's going to be suffering right there. That
so
kind of thing.
Right away.
But there are other actions that are more like, you know, planting a seed and eventually the plant will grow. Mm-hmm. Now what's important about that principle of instantaneous causality is that you have the choice in the present moment. Where this freedom comes from, the Buddha doesn't say. But because we're aware of things and we can see, okay, this next action is related to that, this result is related to that action. I don't want to do that action anymore. You're free to choose not to do it. Which is why you do have some freedom of choice. The Buddha said if everything in the present moment were determined by the past, you would have no freedom at all. So we do have this freedom. That's an assumption that he says you've got to make as part of your working hypotheses here. I did a whole weekend one time at, down in Redwood City on the topic about Buddhist causality and its relationship to nonlinear systems. And the guy who was doing the recording thought it was flaky, so he didn't record it. He said, oh, I forgot to push the button. I found out later on it was, he didn't forget to push the button. He intentionally did not push the button. So, but there's a whole book, Wings to Awakening, and another book, The Shape of Suffering, that go into this.
Wings to
Awakening, Shape of Suffering. And also there's a section in the book on the path that goes into this relationship between nonlinear causality and the Buddhist take on causality. Mm-hmm. Okay, those are the three knowledges, unless there are any more questions. Okay, the Buddha said first there's the knowledge of the regularity of the Dharma. Those are the three knowledges. Then there's the knowledge of unbinding or nirvana. Nibbana. Okay, Nibbana is something the Buddha says, of course, is indescribable, but he goes ahead and gives some indications of, gives some analogies for it. And the analogies, if you look at all the different terms he uses and the names he uses for Nibbana, you can divide them into five categories. The first one is there is a kind of consciousness that is there. It's not the consciousness of the aggregates. It's a consciousness that he calls unestablished, unrestricted, and surfaceless. The analogy with surfaceless is illustrated with the image. You've got a house with a window on the east wall and a wall on the west wall, solid wall. When the sun rises, the beam goes to the east window there and lands on the west wall. Now, if there were no west wall, the question is, where would it land? Oh, it could land on the ground. If there was no ground, where would it land? And they had this belief in those days that there was water under the ground. Well, it would land on the water. If there's no water, it wouldn't land. In the same way, he says that these things that we take as food for consciousness, if you take them away, finally, you get this beam of consciousness doesn't land anywhere. So that's unestablished and surfaceless. So think of a light beam that doesn't land anywhere. Nobody can see it because it's not reflecting off of anything, but it is bright in and of itself. That's the first feature. The second feature is that it is a truth. It is something that is not fabricated. It's unchanging, undeceptive, unwavering, permanence, ageless, undecaying, deathless, and true. In other words, it doesn't change. It sticks, it stays as it always is. So it's a truth that doesn't change. The third quality is that it is bliss. The names that the Buddha gives for it is the exquisite, the unafflicted, the hunger-free, unaffected by death, and peace, rest, secure, security, island, shelter, harbor, and refuge. So So we've got consciousness, truth, bliss. The fourth quality is freedom, release. In fact, that the term unbinding for nirvana. They had this belief in the old days that when a fire went out, it was unbound from its fuel. The idea being that while it's burning, it's actually clinging to the fuel, and it's trapped in the fuel because it's clinging. It's a neat analogy. And it gets freed by letting go. And then it goes into the, and they wouldn't say, didn't say it went out of a, out of existence, simply that you can't find it until it gets started up again. So it's release, unbinding, the effluent free, attachment free, free from longing, non-objectification, the ending of craving, dispassion, and purity. So freedom is the fourth quality. And then finally is excellence. The terms the Buddha has for it is the amazing, the astounding, the ultimate, and the beyond. So that's the goal. It is a dimension. That can be attained through our efforts. It is not caused by our efforts. This is why the Buddha calls the path a path. In the same way that, you know, the path over to the totem poles does not cause the totem poles. But you follow the path and it gets there. So this, so the Buddha was able to find this dimension by examining his own mind and developing the five faculties within himself. And then as he reached this dimension, part of it was letting go of the path as well. Now, every time there's been a change in the Buddhist tradition, that they change the story of the Buddha's awakening. For instance, there's a Mahayana text, it's in the Flower Ornament Sutta, where the Buddha gained his awakening not under the Bodhi tree, but up in the Pure Abodes. In other words, he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, and there came a spot where the Bodhisattvas, or the Buddhas of the past, spirited him up to the Buddha abodes and beamed awakening into him. Make a great science fiction movie. And then brought him back down again. There was a Vajrayana text, and I've forgotten the name, it's the Chanda something, where the Buddha gained awakening, not under the Bodhi tree, but when he was in his palace performing tantric rites with his consort. To invoke the wisdom and compassion of previous Buddhas who then, you know, gave him the awakening. And then afterwards he went under the Bodhi tree because he figured, well, there'll be some people who'll be inspired by that image. Secular Buddhists, they'd say there was no specific awakening experience, simply the Buddha contemplated and studied and finally came to the conclusion that there was no one path for everyone. And we each have to be true to ourselves in deciding what path means the most to us. Now, each of these stories colors our view of the world and our own sense of our own potential for happiness and our ability to find happiness within that world. And if the Buddha had to gain awakening by having, through the compassion of previous Buddhas, okay, that would require one path of action from us. If he did it through tantric rites, that would require another path of action. If there was no specific awakening, again, it would give another idea of what our path was. So you see that each of these different stories is actually creating a different world. I've forgotten who it was. She was a famous American poet one time who said, the world is not made out of atoms, it's made out of stories. And here's, you know, this is the Buddhist story. The question is, which of these stories are you going to take as authoritative in deciding what the world is that you are living in and your potential for finding happiness, and what is the path to happiness within that world? But if we have conviction the Buddha's awakening on his own power, it colors our world and our sense of views, our sense of ourself, and one that we are more than just biological beings. There's a knowledge of unconditioned happiness is possible. I told you earlier about that Buddhist scholar who was talking about how he just couldn't grab the idea that, you know, a biological being like us could find something unconditioned. I made an analogy for him which he did not like. And I said, it's like you can read only three letters at a time, and you read the word antelope, and you see the Buddha's talking about ants. If that's all you can read. And then if someone informs you that, no, it's not ants, it's antelope, you say, well, ants don't elope, that doesn't make any sense. He didn't like the analogy. Okay, one of the implications, as I said, is that we're not just biological beings. Second is that the power of our karma can create worlds, and also it has power to go beyond worlds and reaching awakening based on qualities that we all have in a potential form. And the Buddha said it was by being heedful and ardent and resolute. We all can be heedful, ardent, and resolute in some things, and he's saying just learn how to develop these qualities in your quest for awakening. the third implication here is that awakening is not a matter of being Asian or European. It's something that stands outside of culture, and that acts as a measuring stick for our lives, rather than saying the Buddhism has to fit into our culture now that it's come to this continent or this side of the world. We say there's, John Swat used to make this point all the time, that the Buddha followed what's called the customs of the noble ones. It wasn't an Indian custom or it wasn't an Asian custom per se. It was the customs of the noble ones, which go beyond the customs of any particular country. And John Mun used to get a lot of criticism for not following the Thai or Lao customs as he revived the forest tradition. He said, if I want to become an awakened person, I have to follow the customs of the noble ones, not the customs of a nation that, the customs that are based on greed, aversion, and delusion, basically. Fourth point is that true happiness can be found only through developing good qualities of the heart and mind as skills. It's interesting to note, in most Buddhist countries, the word for heart and mind are the same word. They don't make the distinction that we make in English between your emotional side and your intellectual side. It's kind of the goodness of the heart and the goodness of the mind are two things that work together. You would think of some good-hearted people who don't necessarily have smart minds, or people who have good minds but necessarily good hearts, but Buddhism said the two qualities have to go together to develop this path. So you can see why conviction, defined in its traditional sense, is a strength that empowers us to have confidence in our ability to develop these qualities needed for true happiness. It gives us a sense of the world and a sense of who we are in that world that offers hope for a genuine happiness that's more than long-term but actually stands outside of space and time, and yet we can touch it within our own experience. Now, this is going to be different from the world inhabited by the people around us, but again, and their view of the world can sometimes deter us from fully taking on conviction in the Buddha's awakening. But why we should let other people around us limit us in that way? The Buddha states that we're not necessarily prisoners of our culture. We can think of ourselves more as anthropologists from Mars, looking at the human world. This is a really strange world we live in. And in America, I don't know if they have them here in Canada, but they had these classes where people got together and said, suppose you have only one more year to live your life. You get together and talk about what your sense of priorities change if you said, well, this was my last year to be alive. We could take as another experiment, a group of people get together and say, suppose I really believed in rebirth and the relationship of karma to rebirth. How would I change my life? I know one person down in California, I mentioned this to a couple years back. He came to me a year later and he said, I really resisted what you were saying that day. And then he said, I stopped and reflected on it and I realized why, which was because it would mean I would have to do a better job of living my life. So that's the, having conviction in the Buddha. Any questions on that section of this type of conviction or this aspect? Was it that hour in the afternoon when? Yes.
So it's more related to the relationship between stream entry. So as I understand stream entry, you get the first taste of awakening. Mm-hmm. So what happens between this one and non-returning? I forgot the steps.
You have stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahantship. And within the forest tradition, they talk about how basically from stream entry, you've had your taste also of jhana, of right concentration, but you haven't mastered it. Next to it is to master that. An important part of mastering concentration is also to try to weaken your passion for sensuality. Your stream enters, can still get married, still have kids. It's a non-returner, you can't do that anymore. So there has to be some contemplation of sensuality. Why are you still stuck on sensual pleasures? They basically say that stream enters have perfected virtue, but they still need more work on their concentration and discernment. Non-returners have perfected virtue and concentration, but they still need to work on their discernment. That's kind of the relationship. The analogy that the Buddha gives is of the difference between a man standing on the edge of a well and looking down and saying, yes, there is water in the well. That and someone who actually jumps down into the well, fully immersed in the water. Yes?
My question has to do with the description of the Buddha, one of the descriptions of Nirvana, and that is the aspect of being permanent. To my untrained mind, I struggle with that. What's the teachings, the conditioned thing is being impermanent?
Well, Nirvana is not conditioned. Okay, well, if you're basically, even in the first taste of Nirvana, you realize you're just stepping outside of space and time. And once you're outside of time, nothing's going to change. So it's a different dimension. That's the best analogy I can give. And as you're stepping outside of time, either when you're stepping out or stepping back in again, you realize that time didn't start with, you know, the year you were born. Or your experience of time did not start then. It goes way, way back. You may not know the specifics of what different rebirths you've had, but you realize it's been a long time. Yeah. Are you having trouble hearing?
Yeah, I turned it up.
Okay. My voice gets kind of raspy this talking all day. Yes.
This dimension, is it possible to experience it momentarily while you're alive, or is it you're there and it's you're there?
Well, for the first taste of awakening, it is during both cases. It would be in this lifetime. Basically, you kind of step out of time and you step back in again. And one of the reasons you step in again, especially after stream, I do say, wow, this is really cool. Whoop, you lost it. The Buddha talks about it as clinging to the deathless. Clinging to the deathless. And then clinging to that, you lost it.
Strong determination. Okay, this year I'm going to achieve sleep entry. I'm going to
1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to achieve. I'm going to accept.
Manageable.
That attitude will probably not get you there. But, but you say, look, I'm going to work on the fact that I'm suffering, and whatever I'm doing to cause myself suffering, I'm going to stop doing it. If I can catch myself causing myself any unnecessary stress, I'm going to stop doing it. And then you just kind of peel away, peel away, peel away. And it's like peeling away an onion. You may not know how many layers you've got to peel away through, but it's that process of peeling away that's going to get you there. And it's not like you say, tonight I'm going to gain stream entry. But you're doing the process again. All of a sudden you hit something that you hadn't hit before.
But how realistic is to achieve stream entry?
I mean, my teacher had some lay students in Bangkok I felt had achieved it. We're talking Bangkok, not Victoria. I mean, Bangkok is crazy, you know. So it is feasible, but they were all people who were really determined. They, you know, they would meditate in their spare time as much as they could. They really were dedicated, and this is a practice I've got to master.
The journey now and working with oneself in the ways that you've been talking about. But I thought of death as well, and so gone through the process of death. Did I make stream entry or not? I don't know. But so you're going on into a new journey, but there's this conviction here now to want to become a better person or want to begin to work with myself. And I thought, well, how does it continue from there? You know, you're perhaps in a new body, but there's factors in life, and you find the thread again.
Well, it's good to have a determination that if I have to be reborn, I want to be reborn in a place where I can practice.
Yes.
And just kind of, and the fact that you actually are doing the practice, that gives some a basis in reality for that determination to actually happen.
I'm not a good meditator. I do everything else first, And then I realized this week, and maybe I'll lose it again, that if I start my day with it before I get going into the little jobs, before I go to the household, then the job, then I actually get it done. Mm-hmm. And I rather enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, you're creating a framework for the day by how you start it. You jump out of bed and you immediately go to the immediate first task. That's, you've lost the perspective.
So the first task now for me is to actually, I didn't want to go all the way down to the room that I meditate in. It's like, just sit here
right.
And meditate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's perfectly fine. The fewer obstacles you make to sitting in the morning. I mean, if you have to go down into the other room, that's an obstacle.
Yes.
But if you say, okay, I can sit right here. Maybe say my back aches, or I can sit leaning against the bed. Whatever. But you can sit in the morning, because that creates the framework for the day.
And I feel like I've done something for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Last night when I came in, my mother's upstairs, and I just go in downstairs and I sat for a short while before I went up and joined her. And
mm-hmm.
It was that feeling like I completed the day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, The taking that time, it creates a framework for everything else. Yes. Case, it was creating an obstacle because she didn't want to walk down to the room.
I'm kind of struggling with, you know, I want to take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Where it would be just a chair in my room, but it's someplace I go, and that it becomes focus.
Right. The advantage of having a special place like that where you meditate is that it's, as soon as you sit down there, say there's only one thing you do there. Which is that you meditate. And it is good to have it clean with not a lot of laundry lying around. And sometimes it's good to have these ceremonies and rituals for yourself to give you a little leg up. I was in Yosemite National Park one time, and I was up at one of the viewpoints taking some pictures, and the man standing next to me was pointing out these different peaks that were up kind of around in the Sierras, and they were his own personal four favorite holy mountains, he called them. Like, you know, like the Chinese have their four holy mountains, and these were his personal holy mountains up in the Sierras. And then he said, but then, of course, every place is holy. And I thought to myself, well, if every place is holy, where are you going to go to the bathroom? I mean, there are some places that are holier than others, you know. So it is good to have a spot. If you find it helpful, find a spot that's special. But if you wake up in the morning and say, oh, that special spot is, you know, I have to go across a cold room to get there. Okay, I'll sit here and meditate here. Yes?
For me, it wasn't just going through the cold spot. It was like, oh, that floor needs washing. Or those dishes need doing, or I need to put on the kettle. And
mm-hmm.
those are the things that pull me away.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Would you recommend, I've heard someone had recommended in the past meditation on the Buddha's awakening, like Buddha Anusati?
Buddha Anusati, yes.
Is that something that, that would help to strengthen conviction?
It certainly does. You think about the Buddha's awakening, that here's a human being who was able to do it. And although he was special in a lot of ways, he was a human being. And if he could do it, I can do it. Or if the Buddha is too much to think of it, you can, if you ever read any of the Theragata or Therigata, the verses of the elder monks and nuns. And in some cases, those people were pretty miserable. You know, they couldn't get any concentration. They got suicidal because they couldn't get any concentration. And yet they suddenly came to their senses. He said, okay, I haven't gotten suicidal yet, so maybe there's hope for me. But reflecting on this, that this is something that human beings can do, because you look at the examples you get around you in the culture of what people are doing to find happiness. And if you think this is all there is, it gets pretty depressing. And it gets very limiting. So it's good to think about, oh, here's a human being whose example I find inspiring. I'd like to emulate what he's done. And I know some people say, well, he was a man, I'm a woman, or he was white and I'm black, and doesn't seem to relate to me. He was a human being. When he tells his own personal story, the only detail he gives was that he was really wealthy when he was young. And which shows that when he's talking about the drawbacks of sensual pleasures, he knows what he's talking about. It's not sour grapes. But beyond that, everything in his that he tells about his awakening is can be made universal. Okay, one final factor of stream entry is virtues appearing to the noble ones. I mentioned this earlier. Once you've confirmed that the Buddha taught is true, there is a deathless happiness that can be attained by your own efforts. And stepping out of sight of space and time, you begin to see the process of suffering has been going on for a long time. You realize that what kept you from having that experience was your own unskillful actions. So as a result of this insight, you would never intentionally break the five precepts again. So when I say that your virtues are untorn, unsplattered, etc., that's what they mean. Okay, However, you see that there's no need for a sense of self in that deathless experience, and it's not created by a becoming. You don't see any need of sense to create a sense of self around continuing your practice of the precepts. It's something that's become automatic, something that's become natural to the mind. And this is why what's meant by saying the precepts are not grasped at. You don't pride yourself, and you don't look down on for observing the precepts. You don't look down on other people for not observing the precepts. There's no need to define a self around that. However, they say there still is a lingering sense of I am around your development of concentration and discernment. That's still work that needs to be done. And you still need to talk yourself into why this is a good thing, why it'll be good for you to do this. So that's the fourth of the four factors of stream entry. So here again, you have the issue of who you believe in, what you believe, and what you do as a result. In this case, you believe in the Buddha. It teaches you that their actions matter and they have potential for great good or great harm. You believe in the Sangha, saying, okay, there are people who followed what the Buddha taught and they were able to get the results. The what you believe is the true Dharma that leads to happiness without harm. And what you do is you hold to your virtues, but you are true in your virtues, but you're not clinging or grasping at them anymore. Now, even when you haven't reached stream entry, you still want to be as scrupulous as you can about your virtues, because they are a basis for mindfulness. Because remember what mindfulness means. It means the ability to keep something in mind. And if you're tied up in regret about what you've done, one of the mind's first reactions is to create a wall of denial, which makes it harder to remember things. So, in order to develop mindfulness, and also the simple fact of keeping a precept in mind strengthens your mindfulness. My teacher had a student one time who saw her friends taking the eight precepts. So she came to the monastery one time and decided to take the eight precepts. And in the afternoon, when you're not supposed to be eating on the eight precepts, she walked past a guava tree and the guavas looked so nice and so fresh, and before she knew it, one was in her mouth. And the John Fung happened to be standing nearby, and she said, "Oh, I thought you were taking the 8 precepts. She felt really bad about it. He said, "Well, what you should remember is there's the one precept you should always look after, and that's the precept of taking care of your mind. In other words, try to be mindful."
What is meant by the noble ones in that passage?
The noble ones here would be anyone who's had stream entry or gone beyond. Yes.
I'm not sure if you went into the Sangha. I have a question about the verified confidence in the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, confidence. So there are so many Buddhist monks
mm-hmm.
that don't behave
mm-hmm.
well. You know, some of the examples for teachers that they say they're Buddhist, but they don't practice the true Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
How can you...
Okay, for having confidence in the Sangha, you have to remember there are two meanings for the word Sangha. One is the monastic Sangha, and there's the noble Sangha. Now, the noble Sangha can be made of lay people or monastics, but they're the people who have at the very least had their first taste of awakening. And the only way you can confirm for yourself that there are such people is if you become one. And then you figure, if I can do it, there must be other people who can do it too. There's a sutta where the Buddha's being visited by this one guy who comes away who's really impressed. And he goes and he tells his friend, "You know, that Buddha, he's really awakened, you know." And the friend says, "How do you know?" And he says, "Well, it's like an elephant hunter going into the forest. He sees the footprints of a big elephant. He realizes, oh, this big footprints, this must be a big elephant. The same way I see people coming to see the Buddha to argue with him, and even before they open their mouths, he's converted them. He must be awakened." And so the friend says, "Gee, he sounds really impressive. I want to go see him sometime." So he goes. And he tells the Buddha the friend's analogy of the elephant, and the Buddha says, "That's not the right use of that analogy." He says, "You go into the forest, and suppose you're an elephant hunter, and you want a big bull elephant because you've got some heavy work to be done, and that only a bull elephant can do. And so you come along and you find some big footprints. Now, because you're experienced, you realize, okay, this may not be a big bull elephant. Why is that? Because there are dwarf females with big feet." But it looks promising. Okay. And then you follow the footprints for a while, and then you start seeing scratch marks up in the trees. And you don't jump to the conclusion that it's a big bull elephant because there are tall females with tusks, so maybe they made the scratch marks. But they look promising, so you keep following. And then finally you get to this clearing, and there's a big bull elephant. You've seen him, and this really is a big bull elephant. And in the same way, the Buddha says, when you start practicing yourself and you see the seeing the footprints is when you gain your first taste of jhana. But that's not proof of the Buddha's awakening. And then you move on, the scratch marks are the psychic powers that come, but that's still not proof. It's finally when you reach stream entry, that's seeing the bull elephant in the clearing. So that's how you get confirmed confidence. Okay, there are members of the noble Sangha. Yes?
Could you please clarify for me what is harmful and not harmful? The first precept I know is not to take life, which seems quite clear to me, but when you get into harmful, not harmful,
okay, the Buddha's pretty clear on this, that it's either you break one of the precepts yourself, that's being harmful, or you tell somebody else, or you try to influence other people to break the precept, and that's harming them. But you... That's not a precept, that's a general principle.
Maybe my question is about that general principle.
Okay. We live in a world where we have to eat, right? And there's sort of going to be a burden placed on some people or some being in some way, no matter what our diet is. And so, but for the purpose of the precept, the Buddha is speaking specifically about things you do yourself or things that you get other people to do or tell other people to do. Now, the ecological ripple effect beyond that, that's up to you to decide how far you want to trace that. But for the purpose of training the mind, and these are called training rules, you focus on, okay, what am I doing and what am I trying to get other people, telling other people to do? Focus first on that. And again, remember the Buddha's definition of harm for yourself is, one, breaking the precepts, two, giving into passion, aversion, and delusion in unskillful ways. And then harming other people would be to try to give rise to greed, passion, greed, aversion, and delusion in them, or to get them to break the precepts. Start with that. We have 5 more minutes before the break. Any questions before we break? Yes, Lex.
You mentioned some relationship between memory and a wall of denial.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Buddha says that one of the bases, there are 2 bases for mindfulness practice. One, he says, is views made straight. In other words, you straighten out your views about karma. And secondly, is virtues pleasing to the noble ones. Skillful virtue. Because if you know that you've done harm, then you tend to deny it. And either that or else it's just kind of an open wound and you just don't want to go there. And so, but if you're trying to develop mindfulness, you're trying to develop your ability to remember back about what your actions were and what the results were. So you can draw on that knowledge when you're making your decisions right now. So one way to help kind of clear up your mindfulness is to just not do the sorts of things that would harm other beings. That way it makes it easier to remember. I know my father, when he passed away, as he was approaching death, he was reflecting back in his life, and he'd realized he'd really mistreated my mother. And you could see that here he was. Where was he going to focus attention? In the present moment was not a good place to stay. The future was pretty bleak. And thinking back in the past, that was that kind of the wound that he had. And so he was really troubled. And so the fewer of those things you have to look back on, the easier it is to cast back your memory to think of the good things you've done. And to learn from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Can you explain what Dhamma is?
In this case, it means basically the Dharma as the Buddha taught it, the Dharma for the sake of dispassion.
It's
the teachings. The Buddha, in Dharma, in Pali, can mean lots of different things. It can mean the Buddha's teachings in particular. It can mean qualities of the mind. It can mean actions. There's that one use of the word as well. And bring all of these things together, and basically you ask yourself, what qualities of the mind, what actions can I do that would lead to skillful results? That would all count as Dharma. And when the Buddha talks about the true Dharma, he's talking about there was a period, for a couple hundred years after he passed away, where there were no alternative versions of the Dharma. So when you talked about the Dharma, everybody knew what you're talking about. And then as different schools of thought began to develop and you had multiple versions of the Dharma, he said it's like when counterfeit money appears and all currency becomes dubious. So in that sense, the true Dharma died over 1,000 years ago. But we can see that there are passages in the text that seem to be more reliable than others. In my own experience, the most reliable people I've met in my life were the Forest of Johns in Thailand. And they had a lot of respect for these texts. So I sort of made the connection, okay, good people have been sort of certified that these texts really do work, so that's why I give my life to that practice. Yes?
I'm sorry, I have trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry.
Not you, my hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say the Dharma of dispassion?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I have not familiar with that.
Well, the practices that lead you to dispassion,
yes.
That's one of the...
Attachment, non-clinging,
right. The Buddha gives, there's that passage where his His stepmother comes and asks him, can you teach me the Dharma in short? He says, there are certain qualities you look for in the Dharma. One is that it leads you to dispassion, to being unfettered. It leads to you being content, unburdensome. That leads to some of the other things. There are 8 qualities altogether. I can't remember all 8 right off the top of my head. But I'm sorry about my voice. I try to leave messages sometimes on cell phones, and the machine says, "Are you there?" Yeah. Yeah, the true Dharma is always there. It's simply the case that sometimes it gets obscured. No, apparently some of these microphones on some of these phones are not designed for this wavelength. Frequency. Okay, let's break for half an hour and come back here a little bit before 3, and we'll continue with the next session on the topic of persistence.